With enthusiasm, greetings and welcome back to the Library's Lead Podcast, Season 4, Episode 31, March 2024. ACK, apparently we have a Garfield fan who's writing our scripts. ACK, school libraries under attack. I'm Dave Lankus, the Bowden Professor of Librarianship at the University of Texas, Austin, along with Beth Botan, Assistant Professor at Syracuse University School of Information Studies, and Mike Eisenberg, Dean Emeritus of the University of Washington iSchool. Thank you for listening to the Library's Lead. Please spread the word. Ooh, I should do this as a rebuttal to something. Send us your feedback at info@libraryslead.org or social media. And please review us on your favorite podcast app. We are very grateful to our academic sponsor, the School of Information at the University of Austin. Hi, Beth. Hi, Mike. Hey, Beth. Please remind us of why we're here.
Hi, y'all. We started this podcast because we like to shake things up for the better, and we like bouncing ideas off of each other as we delve into the issues and ideas surrounding our life in our information world, what's going on, and what the future might hold. The podcast is aimed at anyone, professional or generalist, interested in the information and library field, with an emphasis on the roles and opportunities for libraries and information people to make things better. We are very pleased that we have so many non-info people listening and enjoying our podcast. Library's Lead is a monthly podcast. Each episode runs approximately 1 hour and includes 4 segments: a What's Up from each of us, AI Watch, where we react to AI-relevant developments, technologies, articles, studies, and then a deeper dive into a main topic. And finally, we have our awesome library thingies, where we highlight some of the amazing things going on across the globe in libraries and and the information world. So let's get right to it. Dave, what's up with you?
Well, I spent my spring break in Washington, D.C., presenting and being part of something called the Computers and Libraries Conference. This was the first time I attended in person. I'd been virtually last year. About 700 folks there, and really great conference. They had an entire track for the 3 days dedicated to AI and different AI issues, what I thought. We had a, so just quickly, and then I'll shut up. We had this keynote, and the keynote was a startup guy who was telling us how virtual reality was about to, by 2026, have mass adoption and a mass field and take over the world. And all I could do, and I'm sorry to say this, but all I could do is say, I will see you in 10 years when you give the exact same presentation. So, but it was a fantastic, it was a fantastic conference. And I got to present with my son because we were on a research team together. So that was a proud papa moment. Nice. I enjoyed that as well. Other than that, just trying to, you know, get through life in Texas. How about you, Mike? Because I'm not going to put anyone after Beth because we've learned.
Smart.
Yeah.
Well, professionally, I've been in contact with some folks at the University of Washington's iSchool, my old haunt. And I'm going to talk about that later in the awesome library thingy. And on the personal side, I got my knee fixed. I had arthroscopic, and I'm getting better. I'm starting to bicycle again, which is great. I will not jog or run, which is what put me with the torn meniscus in the first place. But I am thinking about pickleball because some of the oldies around here are playing pickleball. I'll put a brace on and see what I can do. So,
could I just say that I'm going to not run or walk in solidarity with your recovery, son.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Beth, what about you, kid?
Okay, I love it because mine is actually also kind of about running, except for that I'm walking. So there's Fish has a song. You know, when I talk about Mo, my favorite band, a lot. Fish is my best friend Lisa's favorite band and a lot of people's favorite band. And they have one song that's called Run Like an Antelope, which I will link for everybody. It's my friend Nikki's favorite song. She's got an antelope tattoo, and they have a Run Like an Antelope running club. And they were doing a special challenge to get 555 miles over 55 days. Fish also has a song called 555. So that was kind of the impetus. And some of my Mo friends decided we should join that Fish running challenge and see if we can beat all the Fish teams. So I signed up to help because they'll count walking and yoga. And, you know, you've got some kind of conversion charts for how many miles. And Since March 1st, I'm up to 36 miles walking and doing yoga, which is pretty good. And our team already crushed the 555 days. We did it in about 10 days instead of the 55 days that we had. And we're beating all the fish groups. We're in first place. But I thought the most amazing thing was, I was like, I'm just going to do this to like join and have some community support. And I mentioned that I was in Syracuse when my team was introducing themselves. And Al, the guitar player from Mo, messaged me and said, hey, I don't live that far. If you ever want to run with me and my wife, you know, let me know. We'll run. And the truth is that I'd rather get swallowed up by the earth hole than have that man and his wife watch me run anywhere. So then I had to figure out how to like respond to this incredibly kind offer from like a person who's like, you know, I have posters of all over my house. So it was super amazing and kind and super supportive. It's another reason why Mo is my favorite band, I guess. And then the last thing is it was my birthday at the beginning of the month. And so Brian came up to visit and we did Underground Railroad stops from Syracuse to Canada and like fled to freedom and went to Niagara Falls. And there's a museum in Buffalo, the Underground Railroad Museum, that kind of talks about crossing the last river and kind of just thinking about, you know, the power of like actually making that journey. And then like, if you knew Niagara Falls was like 30 minutes to the west, would you have crossed that river? Cause I would not have. But it put lots of things in perspective and was like a special trip. And then on Saturday, we took a Taylor Swift cookie decorating class. So now we both can decorate cookies. So we got to mention Taylor Swift every podcast.
I would just like to take a moment for people who may not be familiar with music and just join you in thinking about the idea of how challenging it is for fish to run. So,
yes. Well, the fish run like an antelope, and so that's an important
Dave, part. You kind of got cut off a little. Could you say that again?
I'm just saying.
Could we pause a minute and let go?
I'd just like to shout out to people who may not know the music scene, because I think we can all agree that fish running is, in fact, challenging.
Okay. All right. And thank you, Dave, for having me go first, because, again, to follow Beth on that would have been impossible. But I am going to move to AI Watch, segment number two, AI Watch, and I'm going to start it out. So I was looking, our topic today is going to be about school libraries and library information programs in education. And I was looking around and I found the Seckinger High School in Buford, Georgia. I don't know if you guys know about this. It's a new school that opened in 2022, 2023, that distinguishes itself as the nation's first AI-themed educational institution, committed to cultivating the next generation of technology pioneers and innovators, ensuring students graduate with skills and knowledge to live in a rapidly evolving future. Quote, end quote. Today, students are graduating into an ever-changing work landscape. Seckinger High School and the focus on AI ensures that students are prepared for what's ahead. And I wound up doing a little research about this place and whatever, and it's amazing. And it's not what you think, that there's a one class or there's, you know, a special track. It's integrating AI and AI type knowledge and innovation into every aspect of the school. Even the county, this is Buford, Georgia, has an AI framework developed by the school's AI department, which is at the county level. And it has to do with programming and data science and ethics and creative problem solving. It is friggin' amazing. They have AI literacy and tools. There's an AI student advocacy and accountability council. And they talk about how to integrate the framework, establish ethical AI use during assignments and so forth and so on. I also looked at their media center / library, whatever, because I wanted to find out about the people. Well, it turns out that not only do they have like four or five staff people, they have three professionals and three assistants because they are the information and technology unit in their school as well. But they even offer a library science elective in the library where the students learn things like doing design and digital things to help the program and the like. And I wound up talking, I actually made a quick phone call and I talked to Joni Gilman, who's the media specialist, and she didn't know who I was, but that was okay after I got over that. I kind of explained a little about what we're doing and that I was just blown away by what's going on. I left a message for the principal. I learned about a lot of the things that are going on there. And this is a real model school for approaching. It's not just about AI. AI is the buzzword, but they're really integrating all things technology into learning through the classroom in a way that helps the students to be critical users of this stuff and not just blindly going into it. I tell you, I think it's a leading place that we should be aware of. So how about that?
Okay, very cool.
You next?
Sure. So I was reading up about, we're doing a project looking at state libraries' role in AI, blah, blah, blah. And one of the things the Brookings Institute is also looking at AI and around AI and AI features. And they just came out with a sort of editorial piece on how public AI can strengthen democracy. It'll be a link in the site. And it calls for a public AI infrastructure. The notion being that given the difference, I know you said this before, the difference between say how the web evolved, which is very democratizing technology, because while yes, there was a floor of technology you needed to get there, it was very low computationally. People could put up their own website, share relatively easily. AI and these large language models just are humongous computing sinks, which has big impacts for climate and elsewise. And they're being developed by corporate interests, which may have potential problems in terms of business models, et cetera. And the call was to create a public infrastructure. This was calling for a federal, even a federal agency around this notion that would create it so that public institutions could use this infrastructure, not just generative AI, but machine learning and all these capabilities. And the only reason I want to bring this up is one, an interesting question. And one of the things that we're going to be discussing among our state partners is there a significant role for libraries in this public infrastructure? Rather than building it as one big federal infrastructure, build it as a truly distributed and hyperlocal infrastructure with libraries providing some of the distributed computation, but more importantly, the training data, the guidance, the audits of the examinations and the instruction for. And so I think it's a really neat idea for us to play around with about creating public infrastructure to use some of this technology, particularly if we don't need it. And then when you have a lovely, awesome magnet school around AI, they would have the ability to go in and try this and play this as well. So that's mine. Beth, what do you got?
Cool. So I really have a resource that is going to be resources for all of our school librarians that are listening, our teachers and administrators. So I have a lot of concerns about AI, but I think we know that it's like rapidly being embedded into our school systems. People are using it to think about banning books. They're thinking using it to build curriculums. I see archivists using it to like create metadata, right? Like we see all of these kinds of amazing ways that people are incorporating it. And so I think, you know, part of our job as school librarians specifically, right, is kind of this intersection of, and Dave and Mike, you'll love this, AI and information literacy, right? Because as we're starting to interact with AI more and more, should the ways we teach information literacy shift and change? How do we prepare our students to critically evaluate and interrogate the kinds of information that they're getting from these, from bots and things? And so I don't know that it inherently has to change. So what I found, but you know, it's a thing for us to be thinking about, but I found a list. If you're not familiar, LibGuides are kind of a resource that librarians work to put together a whole bunch of resources collectively This LibGuide is from the Massachusetts Library System, and it's focused on ChatGPT and general AI for school librarians, teachers, and administrators. And they have all kinds of great resources for how to think about this in terms of like information literacy, how school librarians can help explore different possibilities, how we might use AI to start like motivating students to do different kinds of searches. So one of the article gives an example, like starting off a task, understanding World War II, and kind of how re-asking and reshaping questions can kind of lead students to ask better questions. I found one where teachers were using a Holden Caulfield AI bot. So there's a AI called Character Bot, which kind of seems like Poe, like what we used for Poe, right? And they filled it with J.D. Salinger and specifically Holden Caulfield takes and let the students kind of interact with that bot. And the bot would answer questions like Holden Caulfield. And so, you know, just kind of thinking about all of these ways that we can use it to have the kids engage differently with literature. But then there's also kind of really great information here about like understanding the four stages of AI, recognizing different types, the different goals of it. So I thought all of these resources were really great, but especially kind of pointing to the, we need to teach the students how to evaluate this through some kind of information literacy protocol, which I think is a great mandate for us as librarians.
Well, you know, I couldn't agree more. All right,
go ahead. Isn't there some irony to having Holden Caulfield support formal education? So what should I do on my math class? Just give it up.
Give it up, bro. Just don't go.
On the road.
Algebra's useless.
Yeah. All right, we're going to move on. We're going to take a very short break and then come back with our main topic. Our main topic is ACK, School Libraries Under Attack. And we're going to talk about all things school libraries, media centers, information programs, whatever. So, music, take us out. Okay, we're back and on to our main topic, school libraries under attack. What's going on in education? So, Beth, you and I have both worked in schools as librarians, aka teacher librarians, library media specialists, whatever. And Dave, you have been involved with K-12 education for most of your professional career. And you've done a lot of work with school librarians. What the hell is going on? I mean, mom, apple pie, and school libraries, right? I mean, I recognize the political right-wing agenda to ban books, demonize DEI, and discredit education and educators overall. But is it really working? I hear that there's been some pushback. Is that helpful? Is that good? And what about the decline overall in the numbers of schools and districts that have professional school librarians and libraries? Is it simply a matter of money and finances? And what has the profession done to counteract this seemingly decades-long decline, which, by the way, is about 20% over the past 10 years, a decline in the number of professionals? Something's not working, but it seems to me that the profession keeps promoting the same old program and message and approaches, and they haven't stopped the decline. You both know where I stand. School librarians are one of the only groups of educators directly charged with addressing the serious information and technology issues that face children and their parents and teachers every day. Issues like social media use and mis- and disinformation and information access and use and AI and critical thinking and technology skills. I love my slightly edited version of the mission statement of school librarians, which harks back to 1988. And the American Association of School Librarians said that the mission of the library media program is to ensure that students are effective users of information. Now, we edited that slightly. We added users and producers of information, and we talked about some other aspects, but that's it, right? They're the only educators directly dedicated to ensuring that students are effective users and producers of information. So help me out, guys. I'm retired. You are both on the ground with current students and graduates and connections to the field of education and librarianship. Ack! What gives? Beth, you first.
Yeah, so I spent a lot of time kind of thinking about how to approach this topic because I have a lot of experience in school libraries, being a school librarian, and I'm the person at Syracuse that is responsible for all of the school library courses. I also serve the New York Board of Regents and the Department of Education and as one of their advisors for libraries. And so, you know, I feel a lot of responsibility for the school librarians, especially in the state of New York. When I think about, you know, when I look at our graduation rates for the MLIS program at Syracuse, you know, the only group of students where we have 100% placement is our school library program. They are right, like, and across, I mean, you know, the other programs have great records. None of them have 100% though. And so, but it's also our smallest program. And we've also put the least amount of resources in keeping that program going. And so like I'm, you know, and when I attend board meetings, they love the school librarians in New York, but we have a shortage of them and they need more graduates, but we're really not putting the energy behind that at the university. And so for me, there's a real big disconnect in like where I'm seeing people get hired, the kinds of resources we have in the States, and then kind of like the kinds of students that we are looking at bringing in. One of the programs that I've been working on over the last few years was a program in New York City, which was looking to take teachers who are already certified teachers and help them get their school library certificate. That has been one of my favorite programs to teach at. We get about 12 students a year who come through a cohort. We have some summer residencies where they take two classes in about a week-long compressed format, and then they can do the rest of their classes online. It has been really wonderful. They're already engaged in the school system. You know, it has been a really great model for how we credential teachers already embedded in their school systems and kind of help them with this information literacy area. And I think like when we look at book challenges, look at New York City for an example. If a book challenge happens within the city of New York, first of all, the library directors in that county take over the charge. That particular school librarian is never involved. They invite librarians from other schools to come and sit on the committee. I really like that process because I feel like my librarians out in schools are really being protected in this time of climate. They're not even like personally involved with the challenges. And so it kind of removes some of that like contentiousness, I think, because they have a wider community that's like coming in to support them, right? It's not all just on them. And I think for other librarians looking for a model for like how we might kind of think about doing this more comprehensive support, I'm going to post some links to the ways that New York City schools are managing this. On the flip side of this, and I'm sorry, Dave, I'm thinking about the libraries in Texas, specifically Houston. And so there's been a big push in Houston to kind of get rid of the school librarians, but instead turn them into, and you can probably say more about this, Dave, but detention centers, essentially, right? So where we're having kind of behavior modification, punishment happening in the library. And, you know, I've worked at schools in New Orleans where we didn't have a budget line for a librarian and they hired me to teach dance, but they knew I was going to be doing library stuff, right? And so like, to me, that's the opposite kind of what's happening. And like, we don't have money for a librarian. We're going to hire you to teach PE, but we know you're going to do information literacy and books. But like, I'm starting to see the opposite of that, right? Like you have this extra degree in librarianship, you've went ahead and got a second master's degree, and now we're gonna have you just kind of be responsible for detention. And so I see these two very different models of what can happen with school libraries right now. And so I'm starting us there with these kinds of two models of like how we reinforce and support school libraries in one hand and how we're seeing that support dwindle in other places. Dave, what's happening in Texas? or wherever you wanted to talk about, I should say.
Well, let me get to Houston in a second, because it's part of a larger context, not excusing context, but actually more scary context. So when I was director of the program in South Carolina, we had about 300 Masters of Library Science students. At least half of them were school librarians. Once again, 100% high rate. If we could get them to graduation, they were hired beforehand. We worked with several school districts to create teacher to classroom environment. I loved the fact that I was able to hire multiple faculty specifically in school librarianship. It was a good story. If I were still in South Carolina, I could tell you a good story. Except I left. And a couple of things happened in South Carolina. So South Carolina, the superintendent, which is an elected position of education for the state, someone was elected without any background in education and quickly got a master's degree from Bob Jones University so they could take the formal spot. And the first thing they cut formal relationships with the South Carolina School Librarians Association, which was a powerful and great organization.
Yes.
And Texas, Houston is, yes, they're talking about reusing school libraries as intensive learning spaces. Basically, kids who can't work in a classroom and need discipline or observation are separated out, put in this place for additional online learning, training. But don't worry, kids can still get the books before and after school, because that's all it is. That is a takeover of the state of the Houston school district. I don't take that as a malicious act. I take that as a benign neglect act. In other words, they didn't even think about libraries, so they just needed space to happen. Because meanwhile, they're talking about how to get rid of teachers and how to change board systems and how to really look at a school that is not performing well. And so there's a huge debate around the whole thing, transparency, et cetera. And that's, to me, the issue. In South Carolina and Georgia and North Carolina, they have stronger requirements for school librarians than anywhere in the state, which is not what I expected when I went down there. I always thought New York was the strongest. It's not. New York requires them school librarians in high schools and at least one for all the middle schools that can be shared within it. And even then, New York City for decades has been asking for waivers to get out of that obligation. When you have the requirement for school librarians, when you have the legal structures, because schools are being driven by budgets and policies, even if they want school librarians, where's the money going to come from? In South Carolina, the school districts don't even buy their buses. It's all done through the state. It's very bizarre. And so when you see that there's formal structures for them, they thrive. And we can have lots of evidence about. In fact, one of the things that hits me about school librarianship is on a research side, there is more evidence available that school librarians, certified trained school librarians and school library programs, positively impact testing. Now, whether you think testing is good or evil, it's the metric that's used. And it's public libraries don't have that. Academic libraries, special libraries, none of them have that research-based using multilinear regression analysis and sort of as many gold standard traditional quantitative techniques as you can see. For me, the issue is partly what's going on with school librarians, how they can be better advocates. But once again, we're starting to see that because just like people don't think about librarians don't often think about advocacy. They sort of assume that where they are, it's what's happening. And this is where I'm going to get, pardon me as I pull my tinfoil hat. What we're seeing is a consistent and larger action to undermine the education system to prevent the broad dissemination of critical thinking skills going to everyone. We're seeing the attempts to create a differentiated systems where those who have resources can get good educations and those who do not get good education, and that's on purpose. The undermining of school librarians is the same thing that's undermining school systems. It's just and we know that decades past, it was attacking textbook after textbook about what's being taught in the classroom. And now they've taken on school libraries because there is no textbook. They can just find materials they don't want to be there. And it becomes an easy target. But it's less about school librarians being groomers and libs and much more about how do we depower public education? How do we control what knowledge gets passed between generations? How do we see what narrative goes, which is part of a larger fragmentation of the narrative we have as a country. where we have suddenly people with different backgrounds, different colors, different perspectives, et cetera, suddenly wanting to talk about what makes America America, and it doesn't meet a traditional structure that was in place and enforced for a long time. So to me, the issue is, do school librarians continue to do a great job and expect to be seen that way? Or do we look at school librarians being part of a larger initiative to look at the defense of public education in this country? Looking at working with everything from the National Education Association to working with across different disciplinary lines, and to talk about the role of professionals. But really, it's back to book banning. What this has demonstrated is there's lots of public support for school libraries. There's lots of public support, or there's no public support for book banning, except if you look into that data. The Every Library did a big survey, a study around specifically school librarians and book banning. What they found is people are against it, but maybe not against everything. Maybe they could not have these kind of books. And maybe I'm okay with this one. In other words, it's not a hard no. It's a soft set of resistance towards it. And it's going to take crafting and messaging. And we know that the American Library Association and the Association for School Librarians have not had the greatest ability to do the political power-based advocacy that's necessary. We have a great story to tell. We're not telling it. But we also have to not just assume that the story will be well received, there are people actively working to undermine good efforts. Sorry. So there's my paranoia for the moment. But yeah. Mike, you're the one who's been fighting this fight the longest.
Yes, yes. And it's exhausting and it still drives me crazy. But I think you made both of you make some really, really good points. The first is it is a broader fight. It is the education fight. It is the literacy and equal opportunity for all members of society fight. And I think it's important to frame it that way. I think you're right about the research showing that school libraries make a difference. And I think, Beth, that's great. However, what did you say, 12 or 14 students for New York City? How many schools are there in New York City?
You know, so many.
You know what I mean? Now, and it's more than just advocacy and the message. I think it's also the program. And this is something that I have worked on for 40 years, that yes, school librarians do great work, but there's no consistency in exactly what they do from school library to school library, because the people making the decision in a particular school about what should be done, you know, the information literacy teaching program, the reading advocacy program, and the collections and information infrastructure, those are the three big things. Those decisions are usually left to made by the teacher librarian, the school librarian, her or himself. And so you wind up with this tremendous variation. I'm a teacher in an elementary school in upstate New York, and I have a great school librarian who's very involved with my curriculum, and we've organized integrated lessons with around units. And then I go somewhere else, either in the state or in South Carolina, and they have a great school librarian there, but that person does something totally different. And so what I have advocated, and I did this in the state of Washington for a long term, we created what we call the LIT program, the Library Information and Technology Program, to say, what is it that every school library does? And we tried to narrow the focus. You know, you look at the national standards, and there's two book worth of standards on information literacy. And I'm saying, no, choose two things that first graders need to learn, and make sure that every student in your school learns those information, and third graders and fourth graders and fifth and so on. Narrow the focus. Also, you form a library and information program advisory committee who makes the decisions about what the priorities are for our school. Do we need more assistance in reading advocacy and promotion of books and reading and even electronic, because we don't do very well? Or do we have this amazing program across the school and our reading scores are off the charts, and let the teacher librarian focus on something else? And So I think some of it is that old, pogo, we have met the enemy and is us, problem in school libraries, in that we haven't said that every school library needs to do X, Y, and Z, and we can focus on that. And so I think that that is part of it. By the way, the state of Washington last year passed a bill promoting and advocating what every school library should do. And it even references the Library Information Technology Program. But when I went to the local organization's webpage, and it used to be the Washington Library Media Association, it's now part of the Washington Library Association, which I advocated for, but it's lost in there. There's no strong set of resources helping every teacher librarian, every school library, to in fact decide what the program should be and delivering it on that. So what I would like to see as part of this broader movement, Dave, in education, whatever, is that we really very narrowly define what a school library program, and we in Washington State actually changed the name to Library Information Technology Program and Teacher Librarians, because they are teachers in education. I think that that focused on it, that we developed that and we hit hard on the kinds of reading and technology advocacy, including AI, the building a full range of collections and resources. And I'm going to say just a little something about that before I turn it over, because I know I'm on the soapbox and I got to be careful. And the what we do in the reading, what we do in the collections and the resource infrastructure, and then the information literacy skills, I think, yeah, let's rebrand it under AI, you know, what every kid needs to know about AI, and let's develop lessons for each grade level that either a classroom teacher or the teacher librarian delivers to ensure that every student gets that learning. And there's a quick comment about collections. So I get really in trouble with teacher librarians and stuff. And I think the fact that every teacher librarian develops their own collection is a total waste of time. That every school is not unique. In New York, they have a standard curriculum across the region, regions across the entire state. So shouldn't every elementary school library have a core collection of resources of about 75% and then 25% that they can, you know, they can localize and add special things to? But let's guarantee that and take that time sink of collection building away from the individual school librarian who doesn't have enough time to breathe, and do that together on a statewide or at very least on a countywide level. And with that, I rest my case.
So a couple of things. So one is that, like, when I teach the 511, the introduction classes to librarianship, I'm like, you know, a lot of y'all will go into public libraries or academic libraries or special libraries where you will have one of these jobs, unless you are a school librarian in which you will have all of these jobs. And it's right, like collection development, it's teaching, it's cataloging, it's reshelving the books. Like, you're actually doing like every library job in one place. So like, I do think there in Louisiana, we had like, you know, in order for your library to be ranked superior, you need this many books in these kinds of sections. So we did kind of have some overall rules kind of about how many books we should have about computers or how many we should have about history, how many encyclopedias we should have digitally and in person. So there were some kind of overarching rules about like what should be in a library based on how many students you had and across different grades. I think those kinds of things are great. It also still allowed me to collect like books about the Bayou and like other things that would have been super sure relevant to our like Louisiana experience. The thing that gets me about this entire conversation and where I think one of the huge problems is that We have them alone as librarians and information professionals. And we can call ourselves teacher librarians all we want, but like the principals don't often take classes on how to use libraries. The other teachers don't take classes on how to use the library. And so when we have school librarians, like, yes, absolutely, Dave, our job is to advocate. But like, we're also advocating to a group of people that often don't understand how we could be using the library in an education place. And so like, is part of the issue that like the iSchool is over in the library or over with the, is the school library program is at the library or over in the information school? Should we really be in the education department? Like, should we be over there with the schools where we understand what the principals are learning? And it makes me think, I know you know Barb Jansen in Texas, but also Marla McGee, who wrote the book, Principal's Guide to Powerful Librarianship. I learned about their work when I was on the Laura Bush Foundation. And like, I don't think I'd ever had anybody talk to me ever about making these kinds of arguments to my principal. And I think the same things are true in like in order to advocate for like city councilors or the general public about what we do. But like within educational institutions, I find that the conversations about information literacy, about school librarians are siloed to this one space and are not incorporated in the way we approach education generally. And so it feels like we are always trying to catch up in this way that's like really disconnected, because like we are supporting the curriculum and we should be teaching them about all the technology, and like information literacy and technological agility are like two of the, and human skills are three of the most important things that we could be teaching people right now in 2024. And yet the group of people who do this have been completely devalued, undermined, and attacked. And Dave, and I agree that it is part of that larger push to criminalize education broadly.
So this is where I end the podcast forever, because Mike's not going to talk to me when I'm done. But there's a lot, Mike, that I don't think I agree with in that one. For example, the notion of one collection for all, I mean, depending on where it is, whether it's county or whether it's school district or whatever, one of the arguments that was made in Florida, to defend book banning legislation, was that in essence, the library was government speech, that the government was determining what information was there and available and therefore should have complete control of it. Now, we don't think that way. We think freedom information. And is that 25% collection where you're able to support LGBTQ and minoritized populations, et cetera? So I understand the labor of it. I'm more worried about how we implement it. And the notion that we're all this have, I love the idea that we all have common, clear, well-explained goals. And I love that it's the idea of information literacy and technology adoption that is the leader. I like that a lot. How we get to that, I think, varies a lot. And we see that even in education, where English teachers teach differently, but no one questions the value of an English teacher. To your point, Beth, which is, you know, once you get to the point of being able to clearly articulate and then incorporate within the training of administrators, then I think it's great. But I worry that everything that I've ever looked at and thought about libraries is how to look more and more and more like your community and less like some standard. And so I think.
But let me push back a little
yeah,
bit.
Yeah, go.
Because I'm not saying that we need, you know, total collections that are homogeneous across communities. But what I am saying is, and K-12 education is different than public libraries or even academic, in that, again, there is a state or a more local, like in the state of Florida, they're county systems, they're county schools, right? So to say that a collection, and we're not just talking about books, we're talking about the electronic resources and the whole thing. Collections that underpin and support those should be more common than different. Now, you can argue the percentage, 50%, 60%, 75%, whatever. I'm cool with that. But I also No, teacher librarians, well-meaning people who spend a bulk of their time reading reviews and picking out things and whatever. And I'm saying, but you built these collections and nobody's using them in the way they should be used because it's not integrated with the classroom. The same thing about the goals versus the implementation strategies. Yes, I think we should have common goals across districts in, say, New York State. But every school is different in the way that those things can be implemented. In some schools, the teacher librarian may need to go in and do certain things in terms of instruction. In my last year as a TL at a high school, we did 180 book talks in the classroom promoting reading and the use of books. All right. That's a decision that we made collectively in the school that we needed to do that because the kids weren't reading and we wanted to promote that. But the other choice would be for me to give that information to classroom teachers and have them do it. And particularly when you have one teacher librarian and maybe 80 classroom teachers, it's ridiculous to expect that teacher librarian to teach the information literacy program. Therefore, they have to help the classroom teachers to teach the information literacy program, but we help to define the goals, the objectives, and even some of the strategies for having it done. So that's kind of where I'm coming from.
And I appreciate the clarification because I didn't want people to walk away thinking what we want is every library to look exactly the same. And Beth, to your point, one of the things that we did, and I wish I could say it turned around and changed the world, and we did it every year, but we tried to work with our College of Education to have teachers who are about to go into their practicum, their fieldwork experience, we presented on what they should be expecting from their school librarian and how they can use them, right? So, and Mike, you can't see this on the podcast, but Mike was doing the fingers interlacing, working together thing. Yeah. Because the other part of this, and I think what allows Mike's vision of more coordination across a school district, you know, there are people in charge of, you know, they're the district-wide English coordinator and math coordinator, whose job is not simply to make sure things are coordinated, but also to provide some basic infrastructure in doing this. And so, you know, and I've always been a great believer that the lever happens at the preparation level, right? We can reach more Absolutely. People more quickly and have larger impact if we can change how we prepare school librarians. And that means that school librarians and teacher educators need to coordinate so that they can teach these things together. And that's something that we can do at a university level. We have that ability and we should just do it, damn it. It still comes back to, I like the idea. Look, not two books of standards. We do information literacy. Here's what information literacy is. We do technology. And I would say technology usage as opposed to basic technology, but we get the point, right? And these are the things we do around it. This is what school librarians do. They do teach information literacy and work with the teachers and the administrators to build it in. Because the other thing that happened at South Carolina at the higher ed level was we required information literacy. In fact, when our high school teacher, school librarians found out it was required at the university, they got lots of knocks on the door for principals to say, hey, this is part of continuation. But at the university, it was like, yes, if you take these kinds of courses, they might have some components and that's good enough, as opposed to you need a math course and you need a history course.
Yeah.
Right. And so, the idea of having an information literacy course, which is a core and demonstrates it, and then you're right, supports in different areas. I like that a lot. I think the idea of streamlining what we're doing and a lot of what we do in librarianship, including when we move to a master's degree, et cetera, is we assume that the more complex we could look, the more important we were. And we often dilute the message because of it.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And what I'll also say, it's not that the teacher librarian or the school librarian is responsible for teaching information literacy, but they're responsible for seeing that information literacy gets learned. That's a big difference, because that way you can say, well, I developed a couple of lessons for the third grade teacher that she is integrating with her students, but I'm involved. And I helped a little, by the way, with measuring that to see whether the students actually get it. So there is that. Look, I am, And we only have a few minutes each, so I'll end my part and then ask each of you to say a final comment. That I do think that this challenging now to education and to libraries because of the censorship and the book banning is an opportunity for us to highlight the programs and the public who seems to take things for granted that the things are just going okay is now woken up and said, oh, wait a second. Well, these people are trying to control what my kids get access to in schools. And so we can use it as an opportunity to go to the public, to go to the school boards, to go to the other teachers, and really to explain what we do. At the same time, internally in the field, I do think we need to do that. You know, I remember once doing an information literacy national event. I was there, and Larry Snyder, actually a professor at the University of Washington, before I got there, chaired it. It was funded by NSF, I think. One of the 10 technology things that every K-12 student should know. And if you wanted to add an 11th, then you had to take away something. In other words, if we limit it and say, what are the 10 things or the 5 things or whatever that I think, and not to water them down or to make it so general that they're useless. And we all know ethical use of technology and AI today, huge, right? That in itself. Okay, I'm done. How about Dave and then Beth, because we don't want to have Beth go ahead
of us. Let's end with competency and put right. Grants in the middle. If we got a line in the Elementary and Secondary Education Act of the federal government that said information literacy was a required curriculum, we would have more school librarians. If we looked at Illinois that passed a law against book banning and said, you know, the next step is to require school librarians in all your schools, we would have more school librarians.
Mm-hmm.
If we began so one is look structurally, because what we're doing is we're trying to build something that does not have explicit mandates. And that means it becomes very determinant to the local district, the local administrator, and so on. And so if we truly believe, and I think there's a pretty damn easy case to be made, that information literacy around dis and misinformation, around AI, in other words, we have lots of hot topics to take to the federal government and say, and state governments and to county governments and say, this is the biggest issue that we're facing right now. Good luck getting your math teacher to be able to teach algebra and you know, your English teacher and say, let's admit that this is what society needs right now, just like we expanded what society needed past social studies and et cetera. And that to me is a strong lever. And I think that part of the case, going back to Mike's point about not, we do all of these things and these things and these things and a huge list, but to say, look, you need your kids prepared to utilize technology in an ethical way and understand dis and misinformation so that we can support democracy and build an economy. Let's just require it. I think that that's better than trying to gain every inch on every ball field in every town in the world. All right, Beth.
I absolutely agree with, and so maybe this is kind of bringing y'all's points together. So maybe where we need the structure is not necessarily in like collection development, but that, you know, the work that librarians are doing and making sure that that's written into our like educational standards and that is mandated through those policies. I think it's a super easy argument, right? We're in an information age where we are rampant with mis and disinformation. So like, if only there were a job that taught us, you know, a group of people who would teach us how to effectively evaluate information critically, we could all do better. And I'll end with this. I don't know if y'all watch Abbott Elementary. It's great. Quinta Brunson is amazing and deserves all of her flowers. But the latest episode this week was called The Librarian. And so Janine, the principal, kind of goes through this like program where she can get a temporary library. The school is based in Philly, if you don't watch it. And Cree Summers comes in. She's been one of my favorites. She's a really popular voice actress, but, was in a different world way back in the day, if you watch that show. And she comes in as a school librarian. She is bubbly. She is enthusiastic. She is an amazing storyteller, but she has rules for the library, which kind of undermine some of the long-term English teachers and the ways that they've been used to using the library, like just going in and taking out the books. And, you know, it was really cute. The kids wanted to know why their teachers weren't as good of a reader as Miss Inez, their new librarian.
Yeah.
And it was a really great take. And I think ultimately the kind of meme that's getting shared about it is like, there should be a librarian in our school's libraries.
So I lied. I'm going to get the last word and build on that. You're absolutely right. And the way we did it in the state of Washington, working with the legislature, was to say, you can have a room in your school that has books in it. You can have a room that, you know, has some technology or whatever. But if you do not have a professional librarian in there, you cannot call it a school library.
Yes.
Or a school library program. School library program, by definition, has to have a professional librarian who maintains and does the program. And then we got that passed. It wasn't passed in law from the legislature, excuse me. It was the Office of the Superintendent of Public Instruction. And they defined a school library having to have a professional. So with that, thank you guys. That was valuable for me. I feel okay. I feel like I've learned some stuff. We're going to take a very, very short break. Come back with our awesome library thingies for this month, the month of March. We're refreshed and back onto our awesome library thingies. Dave, what do you got for us this month?
Part of what I presented at Computers and Libraries was the work of Eric Borstein from the Royal National Library in the Netherlands. He went out and created about an hour-long video talking to some really cool people and me. Notice I don't put myself in that pool. About what the future of libraries is in their wildest dreams video. And I'm not a huge futurist fan. I like to say I'm a sort of presentist. But it was interesting to hear all these people like Gene Tan from National Library Board in Singapore, Sandy Hirsch from San Jose, Jane Caldwell from the president of the Australian Library Association, Nick Poole, a bunch of people come together and sort of talk about some of the issues they're facing and such. So I would say if you get the chance, take a look at the video. It's just a good place to sort of start a conversation. And the link will be in our site. Beth.
Great. I just want to give a shout out this week to one of my favorite school librarians, Casey Boyd, the boss librarian. She's been a librarian. Well, I don't know if I should say how long she's been a librarian. She's been a librarian with a lot of experience in Chicago. She's a school librarian in DC now, and she is a school library activist. She has given more keynotes and talks than we have time to list right here. But I think two of the really amazing things that she's doing is her blog space around school libraries and the kind of work that she's doing. But then also she's got a clubhouse. And so if you remember way back in the day when Twitter was threatened the first time, clubhouses started popping up. And so it was kind of like an invited group online social media chat. And she hosts them quite often around school library topics. And so I think both following her on social media to kind of stay up to date with what's happening around school library activism, if you ever get a chance to see her speak at a local conference or you're looking to bring somebody in to kind of talk about supercharging your school library programs, I cannot recommend Casey enough.
Amen.
Okay, I'm up. Again, I lied. I'm going to do two, just one really quickly. Have you guys seen the short video documentary that was nominated for an Oscar called The ABCs of Book Banning? If you haven't,
yes.
Audience, you've got to see it. It's about right here. Martin County is just one county over from where I live here in Florida. And this 100-year-old woman went to the school board meeting. She created a quilt about book banning and she made an impassioned speech against book banning. But then the really great part were all of these young children, elementary, some middle school, talking about what books meant to them and their just disbelief that someone would ban a book, that someone would want to do that. And it really, I mean, it brought tears to my eyes, but it just gave me a whole bunch of hope for the future when there are kids like this there. And so that was wonderful. And the last awesome library thing I want to do to the iSchool at the University of Washington and its LIS program. And Beth, you may not be aware, but there's a lot going on. And there's someone called Cindy Aden, who is the former state librarian, who is now a professor of practice. And she is really shaking things up. Cindy, I first knew her when she was at Microsoft. She was a corporate librarian at Microsoft. And then later she became state librarian and kicked ass there. And now she's doing it at the iSchool. They're expanding programs and they're doing things. Did you know that the museology program at the University of Washington is now in the information school? And they're working on collaborations between museum people and library people, which certainly makes a lot of sense. Also, the distinguished professor in practice right now is Lorcan Dempsey from OCLC. And he has an article in March American Libraries about AI and libraries, which is excellent. And of course, the incoming professor of practice, the distinguished professor, is going to be Tracy Hall, also an alumni of the UW iSchool, but the recently director of the American Library Association. So when she gets there, and Lorcan's hanging around, I believe, and Cindy, and they're hiring some other folks, and they're looking at new certificates, and they've talked to the dean, and he's supportive. And there's also, people may not know, that the iSchool has a major focus on indigenous knowledge. And there is a program of Native North American indigenous knowledge. And there are a number of faculty in that area. It's not just tokenism. There are more than one faculty people who focus on that. So the iSchool at Washington and its LIS program, which I always worry about to make sure, because the school is expanding in lots of different ways. They have almost 2,000 undergrads in the informatics program, and they're going to expand that even more. But librarianship is alive and well, and I hope, and I told them, Dave, that they may want to reach out to you about some collaboration, and they know Beth, of course, because she's a grad. So, awesome library thingy, UW iSchool, way to go.
Dubs up.
Dubs up.
You know,
go ahead, Dave.
All right, but now I'm going to pull a mic and just not leave it there.
Yeah.
Because one of the issues is UW's heading up an effort of the sort of iSchools and R1 research universities and talking about the importance of the role of having libraries research in top tier research universities. And one of the findings that have come out of that group is that we need a better pipeline because all the people you mentioned are freaking fantastic and untenured.
Yes.
They're not tenure track. And so they come in with a lot of experience, and Lorcan is a great, huge brain and reflective practitioner, but not necessarily someone who's gathering the data. And we just talked about the importance of data here. So my final line, and then I will shut up and do my job, is the idea that while they're doing a great job, and they are doing a great job, a fantastic job, one of the things they're also working on, and Beth's part of that group, and I'm part of that group, and Mega and whatever, is the idea that, yes, but library science still is a core that needs tenure track researchers and part of it. And so let's get some more doctoral students in that area and let's get some more faculty in that area and let's prioritize the hiring and then we will change the world. And that concludes this episode of Libraries Lead. Thanks for listening. Thanks to the iSchool UT for direct support of the podcast. Please subscribe to us and rate us on Apple, iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Please share a review, very important, word out, and or contact us via email at info@libraryslead.org or post on our Facebook group so that Mark Zuckerberg can be brought up to date on exactly what we're doing as a proletariat. On the group Libraries Lead, and again, our resources and references available through our website, librarieslead.org. Bye, Mike. Bye, Beth.
Goodbye, all.
Bye, y'all.